This is Audible.
Blackstone Publishing presents When You Find Me by P.J. Vernon. This book is read by Amy McFadden and Bonnie Turpin. For Barry, never meant to be has never been so much. 1. Gray. I wasn't in the right headspace for home. I wasn't in the right headspace for most things, but certainly not for that house. Piper Point. Not for Mama's company, not for what I'd distanced myself from. The turbulent flight from D.C. had left my nerves rattled, and the insides of my cheeks still stuck to my teeth. The faint scent of gasoline touched nearly everything in that claustrophobic cabin. I'd reminded myself the smell was normal, but I'd still drowned in thoughts of flammable jet fuel. "You're so given to scaring, Gray." Mama's words played on a loop in my mind the entire trip. The drive from Charleston to Elizabeth, South Carolina, clocked in at half an hour, give or take. The closer our rental car drew to home, the tighter my chest knotted. My phone read 3:30 in the afternoon. "Plenty of time to make the Christmas Eve service," I announced to my husband. I didn't believe in God, but Mama could be insufferable. When it came to forcing me into a church, she became divinely so.
"And for you to take a nap,"
Paul replied, eyes on the road, undoubtedly confident that his displeasure for my drinking had registered. I turned to the steepled skyline streaming by in fits and starts. I'd gotten a head start at the bar across from our gate at Reagan National. A 9-ounce pour of buttery Chardonnay to take the edge off the plane ride. That's how I'd sold the first one to Paul. Now he fumbled with his phone, one thumb dancing across the screen while he white-knuckled the steering wheel with his free hand. What was so important that he needed to text and drive? Who was so important? I considered asking him, coming right out and asking, but he assumed I was drunk. When I drank, I forfeited credibility with Paul. Even if I pressed him, he wouldn't feel compelled to answer me. Not truthfully. Instead, I prepared myself to see Mama like a prodigal daughter sneaking home after a party. But I was 29. My Kate Spade purse open between my knees, I unzipped the clear bag for liquids that I'd tucked inside it for the flight. Perfume, eye drops, 2 single-serve bottles of white wine, I hovered so Paul wouldn't see them, and a travel-sized container of peppermint mouthwash. I gargled the mouthwash and spit into an empty water bottle. I didn't need to swallow everything with a measurable proof. 3 mists of perfume to my neckline. 3 was 1 too many, but I was trading Mama's disdain for a simple crinkled nose. Wincing, I sprayed once in my mouth. Metallic flavor stuck to my tongue like bitter glue.
"You smell fresh," Paul said, returning his phone to his pocket and noting my wedding ring. "Have your ring cleaned while we're in town. Heart disease fundraiser's next week."
I turned my ring with my thumb. 3 carats of cushion-cut diamond. Flawless, near colorless. Only perfection for me, he'd said when he proposed.
"No white Christmas this year," Paul added. "Not like D.C.
"No," I muttered. He took the exit for Elizabeth, and the pines and low palmetto trees gave way to a quaint town, an unsuitable mix of colonial and low country. Only the presence of a downtown Dairy Queen kept Elizabeth from camera readiness in a Civil War film. A Dairy Queen and a billboard. The picture caught my eye, stuck to the board in fraying paper sheets, and panic bloomed, wrapping my fingers and toes in tingles. A handsome man with coiffed hair and a distinctive Roman nose, his smile jarring. My cousin, Matthew King, attorney. As a sour taste joined the lingering perfume on my tongue, I scolded myself for not recalling that the dated billboard stood there, for not remembering that Matthew's face would greet me when we turned into town.
As the image shrunk in the rearview mirror, I softened my grip on the door handle and exhaled a long, staggered breath. We cut a left down Main Street, passing Mama's church, Blessed Lamb Baptist. Then civilization vanished again into bare tobacco fields beneath ash skies. Adelaide Drive was a bumpy road. Not gravel, but not exactly paved, either. Like the rest of South Carolina, it wasn't sure what it wanted to be. Short trees and tall grass to one side, saltwater marshes on the other. From Adelaide Drive, you could see Piper Point for nearly a mile before arriving. Beneath an overcast sky, the house sat like a rotting log, concealing secrets beneath its moist belly. A malignant tumor latched onto the surrounding marshside bluff. The King family home. My family home. Named for the sandpipers and killdeer that flitted about the property, Piper Point was a wide antebellum with a double wraparound porch. Six Corinthian columns supported a steep roof dotted with half as many dormers. The Christmas candles in each window did little to lessen its long shadow. They turned the home into a twisted jack-o'-lantern, ready to swallow me whole. Ancient oaks swept Spanish moss, and the palm fronds kept their green well into winter. The whole scene could be picturesque, and growing up, it mostly was. I'd etched it into my memory that way, on purpose. But I'd put more than simple distance between myself and Piper Point. Skidding against gravel, Paul braked halfway round Piper Point's circle drive. He parked behind Charlotte's Mercedes SUV. My sister had driven in from Raleigh. She'd done well for herself after the divorce, and I was happy for her. Before I managed to step out of our car, the front door opened, and a rail-thin woman no older than 30 walked towards us. The new housekeeper Mama had gone on about. "Hello, Gray. Paul." Her smile lit up an otherwise mousy face. "I'm Cora. I'm your mother's new live-in." I nodded a hello as she stepped to the rear of the car, where Paul hoisted our bags onto the driveway. The fact that Cora was a white woman relieved me. I know it did the same for Paul. Mama had no concern for optics. "The blacks in town loved her," she repeated fondly. "Too often." Mama had little to worry about in Elizabeth, but Paul and I were different. We lived in D.C., where optics were all that counted, and even more so with Paul's political future. The wooden steps up the front porch creaked beneath my ballerina flats. Since Daddy passed, Mama had ignored much of the home's upkeep. A bizarre oversight for a woman preoccupied with appearance. And the closer one got to Piper Point, the more apparent the neglect became. White siding peeled like curling fingernails. One upstairs window wouldn't close, and another had been painted shut forever. Snaking vines withered into stringy skeletons rather than grow lush. Crossing the threshold, the air inside struck me first. It was the same stale air my family had breathed for 2 centuries, so stagnant mosquitoes could breed in it. In the foyer, sliding parlor doors cordoned off the joint dining room and salon to my left and the library on my right. Ahead, the staircase climbed to a second story with slouching steps, plateauing in a landing halfway up.
"I'll take your things to Gray's room," Cora announced.
"I'll help you,"
Paul replied, refusing to hand over our rollers.
"This isn't Downtown Abbey, despite what Joanna thinks."
What people thought mattered quite a bit to Paul. In that way, he wasn't so different from Mama. And they got along well.
Well enough for the occasional, "Be kind to your mom, Gray," to fly from Paul's lips.
The only family he had left, an invalid mother, recognized his face less and less over time. I guessed Mama took on an outsized importance to him because of it. Sometimes at my expense. But even he'd been unusually eager to get me out of the city. The suspicion I held over his phone extended to this, too.
"Where's Mama?" I asked Cora as she started up the groaning stairs behind Paul.
"In the kitchen," she answered. "Making your favorite, if I'm not mistaken. Banana pudding."
Charlotte's out back with the twins.
They abandoned me in the foyer. Clutching my handbag and the wine nestled inside it, I made for the kitchen. As I passed the polished stairs, I caught my reflection in the mirror on the landing. The swollen knot in my chest pulled tighter. At least 10 feet tall, the enormous piece of glass was set into the wall, stretching up from the baseboard. Crown moldings, pre-war, Daddy called them, framed the immense mirror. In Manhattan, pre-war meant before World War II. In South Carolina, we had longer memories. Daddy had the mirror taken down and stored in the cellar decades ago when it first broke, but Mama must have set it back into the wall at some point, strangely unrestored. A single crack cut diagonally from one side to the other in a near-perfect line. It gave the appearance of a guillotine, top and bottom blades meeting like clenched teeth. A tingle crossed the nape of my neck. Moving to the kitchen, the sound of a wooden spoon beating a bowl greeted me. Mama could never be idle when guests arrived. The moment she'd heard our car pull around, she'd likely sprinted to the pantry, squawking at Cora that she planned to make banana pudding, my favorite.
Hummingbird!
She smiled as I stepped onto the tiled floor. If I had known you'd be here so soon, I would have had this pudding done an hour ago, she lied. Mama had aged well. She'd let her hair fade to a sophisticated silver, which she styled meticulously. Her breath was always scented spearmint with whispers of cigarette. A string of pearls hung in a graceful knot from her neck, no matter the outfit. An iridescent hangman's noose.
How was your trip?
Her drawl had thickened with time. It was okay. Bumpy. She sat the bowl on the counter and paced towards me.
It'll be so wonderful to have you and Paul and Charlotte and the kids together at church.
Mama's way of decreeing we would each be attending the Christmas Eve service, even though I'd already planned on it. She squeezed me in an embrace that grew tighter the older she got. She never hugged me so close when I lived at Piper Point.
There's alcohol on your breath, Gray.
The hug vanished as she recoiled.
I can smell it through the perfume you've splashed all over yourself.
I stood silently as my face flushed. Very rarely did I resent Mama for telling the truth. She'd had a difficult relationship with it my whole life. But the instant honesty became convenient, she wielded it like a dagger.
Paul's spoken to me more than once about your drinking. You think you can hide it by swimming in fragrance? You smell like a drunk who got hold of too much cologne.
I cleared my throat in an attempt to stifle embarrassment. At once, I was a child again, a bad girl, the tips of my ears burning after being caught misbehaving.
I don't like flying. I drink when I'm nervous. Save the perfume next time.
She pursed her lips, scowling.
And have a cup of coffee. Jesus might have spent time with drunks, but I'd rather not bring one to church.
Itching to change the subject, I looked over her shoulder, outside.
Cora said Charlotte's out back?
She is.
Brush your teeth before you kiss those twins.
Mama's voice and its distinct edge dwindled as I spied the door to the cellar. I locked my knees and whitened my knuckles around the strap of my handbag. Perhaps it was being a little day drunk, or maybe just the feeling of being home again, choking me with invisible hands. But for an instant, I was 9 years old, standing before the cellar door while Matthew loomed behind, his belt buckle pressing into the back of my skull. He turned the brass handle and pushed the door open. A lurching groan, like a foundering ship, followed a wave of cold air, moist and musty. I shook my head and the cruel memory away, but the ground still rocked and swayed beneath my feet.
Go on down, Gray. Go see where the devil lives.
2. Gray. Spots danced before my eyes. I'd arrived only moments ago, and I already craved fresh air. Mama said Charlotte's out back.
Clasping my throat, I made my way to her. Dead ferns in porcelain planters and one Christmas tree, very much still alive, stood in the conservatory off the kitchen. Passing through, I stumbled out of the French doors and onto the patio. The brick courtyard beyond had been better maintained than the rest of the house. I guess Mama kept a landscaper on payroll. Taking deep breaths, I passed the babbling fountain that served as the garden's centerpiece. A stone angel with lichen-covered wings spit an arc of icy water. At high tide, the water's edge stopped 20 yards or so from here, but now only sawgrass and festering mud surrounded Piper Point's naked dock. Charlotte tossed a foam football with her children, Joseph and David, in the crabgrass a safe distance from the marsh. She spotted me approaching.
"Gray!"
she shouted, waving both arms.
"Merry Christmas!"
"Charlotte," I said, taking my sister by the hands as I reached her. I seemed to find a mooring again, and my anxiety uncoiled a little.
"Look at you! You look lovely."
I was thin, but Charlotte was thinner. She'd always been bony, and the divorce hadn't helped. A couple sharp Aunt Grays sounded as my nephews latched onto me, a 4-year-old on each leg, runny noses and 2 shaggy mops of soft hair. I gave one a shoulder squeeze and the other a head pat. I couldn't distinguish between the boys and had given up trying.
"I missed you,"
one said.
"Me too,"
said the other, coughing from the sprint over.
"Christmas is tomorrow, and Mom told Santa to bring presents here instead of our house."
"I'm sure she did, and I'm certain Santa will."
"I miss you guys."
A pang of guilt shot through me as I avoided naming them.
"So much."
Charlotte retrieved the football and tossed it towards the courtyard, sending them both chasing after it.
"You can't tell them apart, can you?"
Charlotte asked. From her tone, I was unsure if she was genuinely offended. "You know that's not true." She deftly changed topics.
"Have you seen old Hattie? I can't believe she's still alive."
Hattie the Catty. The sharp guilt from not naming the twins blossomed into something worse. I'd forgotten about Hattie.
"Queen of the Lost Cats of Piper Point," I added.
She'd be an astounding 20 years old now.
"Where is she?" "Funny, she's the only one that stuck around."
Charlotte motioned behind my left shoulder.
"Maybe she's the monster that killed all her brothers and sisters that year."
I turned, and sure enough, the cat crept through the grass, cautiously headed my way. A tangled mess of mottled black and white fur, she stalked as though unsure if I was still an ally. Hardly the monster Charlotte joked she was.
"Don't bring her in the house,"
she chuckled, but she wasn't kidding.
"The boys are just as allergic as I am."
Though survival was never guaranteed for yard cats, Hattie had been the only one of her unnamed mother's litter to make it. In fact, every kitten but Hattie had vanished the year I turned 9. The mama cat, too. And the shrill cries of the tomcats went silent shortly after, like something had chased them all off, or killed them, or both. After outlasting the others, Hattie, as I came to call her, deserved a little pampering. I made a habit of stealing her away to my bedroom, but whenever she'd been inside, Charlotte's eyes started watering and her throat tightened. She hated the two of us for it. The mottled cat threaded herself through my legs in a figure eight. I stroked her back. In an instant, Hattie transformed from lingering ghost to companion. "I'm still your friend," I whispered, running my nails down her knotty spine. Charlotte sighed impatiently.
"We'd better get ready for church."
She started for the house, but paused.
"You doing all right these days, Gray?"
The earnestness of her question startled me. But she'd been here for a day already. Plenty of time to fill with talk from Mama.
"Of course I'm okay,"
I answered, standing up and forcing a grin.
"I'm gonna walk out on the dock, and then I'll be in for a bath and a change."
Charlotte crinkled her nose.
That stinking thing? Low tide's grown nothing but smellier.
I smiled at her again as she collected her boys and made for the house. When they'd vanished inside, I turned back to the marshes. Charlotte was right. They stank like briny vomit. Dust settled over Piper Point, and the planks groaned as if in pain as I walked to the end of the dock. To each side, swarms of frail sand crabs darted across pocked mud. People said you could sail all the way to New York City without ever venturing out to sea via the intracoastal waterway, of which our marsh was an extension. I didn't know if that was true. I'd never bothered to check. Hattie had followed me to the water before stopping at the shoreline. Now she cried, calling me back to the safety of land. As a rising moon tugged on the tide, the slapping murk began its creep back towards the house. Barnacled pylons shouldering the dock's final plank stood in lapping seawater again. Gulls cried in shrill squawks, and the salt in the air did little to mask the stench of rot. Useless. Like my perfume. My bedroom hadn't changed a lick. Mama called it the yellow room. She'd had the walls painted a calming canary and strewn yolk-colored pillows everywhere. Charlotte had the red room, done accordingly in hues of scarlets. The green and blue rooms were for guests. Cora took the colorless carriage house. Mama's preoccupation with colored bedrooms stemmed from Daddy's failed presidential bid. She'd never live in the White House, so she'd done her best to replicate what parts of it she could at Piper Point. Daddy had flamed out early in the Republican primaries, failing to clench even a third of South Carolina's vote. If he couldn't win his home state, there'd been no point pressing on. It was a spectacular failure, and he had only himself to blame. Himself and a tape recorder. I sat my handbag on my white wicker dresser, a juvenile piece I'd always resented. I don't know how it survived the transition into the yellow room, but my dislike probably played a role in it sticking around, like the mirror on the stair landing. Paul lay on the bed, legs crossed over one another, eyes on his phone. He was so guarded around it. He kept it far from my fingers, and it bothered me. Was he still messaging work? If he was so afraid he'd miss something important, why would he drag me back here in the first place? "You haven't been home in a long time, Gray," Paul had told me weeks earlier. "Show up, hug your mother, strike it off the to-do list for another decade." I'd pushed back. "If this is about your run, you know Mama will be supportive. She'll use her contacts whether we show up this Christmas or not." Fingers skittering across the screen of his phone, he'd not answered me. He'd already made his mind, and his silence told me negotiation wasn't an option. And here we are. I slid out of my blouse. I didn't realize he'd gotten up until his hands were on my shoulders. "I want to fuck," he whispered in my ear. My skin raised in chilled goosebumps, not in an erotic way. Between the flight and the wine I'd gulped to white-knuckle my way through it, my temples throbbed. I didn't want to be touched, and definitely not in front of my dresser mirror. Paul didn't seem to want a reply. He'd already undone my pants and pulled them to my ankles. I didn't stop him, didn't say no. My thoughts anchored to the 2 servings of room-temp white wine in my bag, Paul's horniness the only thing standing between me and my next drink. With a burst of hot breath on the back of my neck, he came quickly.
"I can always tell when you've been drinking,"
he said as he pulled his slacks back up.
"You get dehydrated, and it's like sandpaper down there."
My cheeks flamed. His remark, the truth in it, pricked my heart like a hot needle. He was right. It was biological. I'd had too much to drink. I'd grown dehydrated. Stinging comments from Paul used to be infrequent, but each new instance seemed to embolden him. He tested me that way, pushing me towards some threshold, wearing me down, then moving the invisible line back to push me all over again. There was a time when I'd have erupted in anger, when I'd have demanded an apology at the very least, but probably much more.
Now his digs lingered in my mind like stale cigarette smoke. I used to care about things, all sorts of things. Now everything was muted, static-filled. I still walked amongst sharp blades and needle-like hazards, but their edges had been dulled. It was a broken way of seeing the world, a dangerous one. I collected my purse and stepped out of my pants in silence. In my old bathroom, I twisted the top off one tiny wine bottle, turned it up, and shoved it in the back of a cluttered drawer, then repeated the process with the other. When I finished, I caught my breath. I kneaded and dug at my chest, as though trying to crawl inside myself. The bathwater poured piping hot from the faucet. Mama may have let some things fall through the cracks, but the water heater wasn't one of them. When did it become worth it? When did Paul, the life he offered, and its distance from here, become worth it? The acidity of cheap wine tickled the back of my throat, reminding me that it wasn't worth it, but my priorities necessitated it anyways. My priorities. Now there was something to scoff at. I really did used to care about things. The sick, homeless people at the aid shelter I volunteered for, tossed from their families like subhuman garbage. But empathy was replaced by guilt as I'd catch myself watching the clock. While dying people described what life was like before, I'd zone out and count the minutes till I could go home and uncork a sweaty bottle of chilled Chardonnay. The bathwater fizzed as it mixed with flecks of old soap stuck to the sides of the clawfoot tub. The hot water swallowed my body, and my mind stilled as Paul washed off me. 3. Annie. The buzz-sawing songs of the cicadas outside break in rhythmic waves. The kitchen windows, glass bubbled from the passage of too much time, do little to stifle the sound. It's oppressive. Like Paul. What does Paul think my death will look like? How will he ultimately choose to do it? Will it be painless? Will it come to me in my sleep in the form of a heavy pillow sunk over my face? Only enough time to start to panic before cold darkness swallows me up? Or will he make it hurt? Draw it out? Will he want me to know he's had the last word, after all? That he's won? Will he get off on the fear in my eyes? Know I've seen the hate swirling in his? He came to Elizabeth to find me. Dragged his wife with him, too. I won't let him win. When I think about him and who he really is, it tears me up inside. He gnaws at me like a rat chewing through concrete. Oh yes, rats can chew through concrete, if they're hungry enough, desperate enough. I open a kitchen drawer. A rolling pin, a potato masher, a cheese grater. No, these won't do. I close the drawer, careful to shut it quietly. I spy the knife block out of the corner of my eye. A butcher's knife? A meat cleaver? Honestly, how cliche. Gauche, even. Unlike women more suspicious than myself, I don't carry mace. I should, but I don't. And now here I am, searching for self-defense. I need delicate. The paring knife, that's delicate. Like me, a blade no longer than a couple inches. But there are plenty of important things just a couple inches beneath the surface.
4. Nina. Winters in Elizabeth rarely grew cold enough to kill the crickets. They chirped their sing-songs from the sullen palmettos in front of Auntie Tilda's place. Auntie's mailbox was a rusted-out mess. I made a mental note to buy a new one the next time I drove to Dale's Hardware. It had only been a few days since I last opened it, but it was stuffed like a turkey with letters. The world had a lot to say to a dying woman. I started back up the overgrown yardstones to the house. Another note to myself, asked James next door if he'd mow again this weekend. The gutters that ran the length of her tin roof were swollen with pine needles. Maybe James had a ladder to spare, too. I tugged hard on the front door before it gave. The wood framing buttressing the rickety home had shrunk since summer. Inside, red carpet covered the living room. The last time anyone updated the place, red had been a trendy choice. A tattered recliner, Auntie's favorite in better times, sat before a TV box. A floral-patterned couch pushed against the room's long wall. Above it hung a photo of Barack Obama. She'd been so proud to vote for him. "I never thought I'd live to see it," she told me through tears. In the kitchen, I rifled through her mail. Plenty of bills, but since I'd taken to coming over, the number of past dues had dwindled. Coupons for the Dairy Queen. I stuck those in my jeans pocket. 2 Christmas cards from my cousins. I paused with disbelieving eyes. And 1 from Joanna King. A holly green envelope with a return address label stuck to the corner. The only residence on Atalaya Drive. An embossed K in fancy font. I sat the others on the table. I very much wanted to know what Mrs. King had to say to Tilda Palmer.
"Nina?"
Auntie called from her bedroom down the hall, her voice straining. My wristwatch indicated it was time.
"Coming, Auntie,"
I shouted, pacing to the fridge. The card from the Kings would have to wait. I'd gone through the fridge days earlier for spoiled foods, but I hadn't wiped the shelves yet. A fresh box of baking soda fended off the smell until I found more time. The bottle of liquid morphine sat in the butter drawer. The police officer and me had scratched a tiny pin mark to indicate the level since I last poured from it. James might be good for mowing, maybe ladders, but I didn't trust him around Auntie's painkillers. In Auntie's room, a glass hutch displayed dolls and crystal trinkets she'd collected over the latter part of her life. But her brass bed had been replaced with the one hospice provided. I pressed the side button to raise her upright. Sick as she was, Tilda Palmer wore her lined face proudly. Crow's feet by her eyes from years of laughter and the wrinkled brow of a woman who'd handled more than most. A pile of gray hair sat clipped into a bun atop her head.
"I'll keep my hair, if you don't mind," she'd said sternly to the doctor.
A fiber-optic Christmas tree a bit taller than a toaster sat on the side table. It threw a spectrum of colors across the darkened room as it changed shades to a motor's hum.
"Nina," Auntie smiled. "Anything nice in the mail today?"
"Some Christmas cards. Here, drink up." I held the measuring cap of morphine to her cracked lips. I intended to fetch Vaseline for those next.
"Who from?" she asked after swallowing.
"Auntie Linda's kids, also Terrence and Valerie."
"Nobody else?"
Did she expect a card from somebody else? Certainly not from the Kings. I took a deep breath. I wanted to lie, but couldn't bring myself to. "Joanna King sent one." Auntie cleared her throat with a raspy cough.
"Bring it." "Bring it here, would you?"
"Sure." I walked back to the kitchen table where I'd left the heap of envelopes and plucked out the green one. Auntie started to tear at it, but her eyelids sagged as the morphine kicked in. I opened it for her, and a paper check flitted out, landing on her lap. Written sharply across the payment line were the words, $1,000. Swooping, elegant cursive said the check was for something Joanna King called severance. True, Tilda Palmer had worked at Piper Point for decades. It might as well have been the big house, the way they treated her. For years, she watched over Gray and Charlotte, cooking meals for that family. But after everything that had happened, she was supposed to be done with the Kings. I was only 9 or 10 years old when news of Auntie's secret recording broke. Joanna's late husband, Congressman Seamus King, had been knee-deep in Kentucky bourbon after a bruising campaign day. Auntie had tucked a tape recorder in her pocket and made for Piper Point's library, Seamus King's dinner tray in hand. The whole country heard what Seamus had screamed at her, but I remembered what she told me perfectly. "Don't you ever let someone speak to you like that. Ever," she'd said, trembling. "If you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything." She told me it had only been a single instance, but I never believed her. If it had been the first time he'd gone off on her like that, she wouldn't have kept a tape recorder in the pocket of her frock. Auntie had been careful about it, smart. But why the check? My cheeks grew hot, and I arched my brow. "How long have you been taking money from them?" "Don't mind my matters." Auntie's voice was tinged with stubbornness. Cancer wouldn't wipe that out till the very end.
"Sign my name to the back of that check," she whispered. "Sign it over to yourself. You hear me? I don't have much, but it's what I can do for you."
I stuffed the check in my pocket with the coupons. I had no more plans to argue with a dying woman than I had to cash a check from the Kings.
"You take that check, Nina."
Her eyes closed as she drifted. I gave her hand a squeeze. "Merry Christmas, Auntie." In the spare bedroom, I unfolded the check and sat it on the nightstand next to my badge. Elizabeth County Sheriff's Office, arched across the top of the faux gold shield. Detective Nina Palmer, written below that. All my things, still unpacked. I'd been checking in on Auntie for weeks, but now that the pain had moved to her bones, it needed squashing more frequently. Bigger bottles with higher doses. I'd sat next to her when the Charleston oncologist laid the facts out bare.
"The incidence and mortality rates of pancreatic adenocarcinoma are roughly the same," he'd said, glasses resting on his nose.
"And what the hell does that mean?"
Auntie asked, eyes narrowed. "It means just about everyone who gets it passes away," I told her. The next words out of Auntie's mouth came quickly.
"No chemo. I'm not going through all that mess just to die a week later than if I hadn't."
I didn't blame her. Neither did the doctor. But when it became clear that nobody else planned to help, I'd moved into Auntie's spare room. When the funeral finally rolled around, they'd be bickering over whose flowers sat closest to a dead woman. The one they couldn't be bothered with when she wasn't so dead. I owed Auntie Tilda. She looked out for me, more or less, raised me, even when Mom, forever preoccupied with her next husband, was still alive. Now that Tilda was on her way out, helping her was the least I could do. After pulling on a pair of sweats, I tied my hair back. My stomach growled, and I thought of the fast food coupon in my pants pocket. But the more dusk settled, the more unappealing driving anywhere became. On the twin bed, I flipped my laptop open across my stomach. I began to type Netflix into the web browser, but paused. Instead, I opened Wikipedia to polish my memory. I searched for Congressman Seamus King, scrolling past his biography, his early work for the family business, Charleston Shipping, his career in politics. I stopped at the heading labeled Domestic Staff Controversy. Auntie's check from Joanna King seemed to scream from its new home on the nightstand. The word severance had a very real meaning, but it had been 20 years since Auntie had set foot in that home. At least, I assumed it had been. Why the hell would Joanna King still be cutting her checks? If not because of a controversy dead for decades, then what else might be worth the trouble and the money?
5. Gray. The pews at Blessed Lamb Baptist could straighten out a spine before the collection plate made a single round. No cushion, just hard benches to go with all the good news. We sang O Come Let Us Adore Him as the offering plate zigzagged its way through the pews, collecting crinkled bills and loose change, and Mama's check, folded in reverse so the amount showed. A rotund Pastor Calcutt stood as we took our seats.
"Welcome all, and Merry Christmas Eve," he said,
tufts of white hair clinging to his light bulb-shaped head. Charles Calcutt had been our pastor ever since I could remember, and the principal of Elizabeth Baptist School. He'd been forced to resign from the latter position when his affair with my English teacher, Mrs. Grant, came to light. Mama had phoned to tell me he'd confessed before the congregation. I'd been away at college. Pastor Calcutt begged forgiveness for his transgressions and, in the spirit of Christ's love, was forgiven. As for Mrs. Grant, her husband promptly divorced her and she fled town. I'm not sure what happened to her. At the time, the notion that their two fates could be so different, so unfair, had angered me, as though the plot from The Scarlet Letter had found a small nook in modern society in which it could unfold again. But that was a different time. Paul was charming then, and I was deeply in love. Surviving, or perhaps even thriving, in the world had seemed doable. A fate like Mrs. Grant's felt distant, impossible. Pastor Calcutt went on,
"Such joyous singing! The Lord's heard us, and he's smiling. I guarantee it. Before we get down to business, let's greet one another. Turn to the folks on your left and right, and shake their hands. Wander around a bit. Fellowship."
Hymnal notes rang from the choir piano as chatter and laughter filled the vaulted sanctuary. I turned to Paul as he leaned down to whisper in my ear.
"I love you, Greg Godfrey," he said. "Don't you ever forget it."
I quickly turned to my right and then my left, wondering for whose benefit he'd spoken. It could only be for Charlotte, who sat on my other side, since it sure as hell wasn't for me.
"Charlotte! Gray!"
A voice rang from somewhere amongst the milling suits and doily collared dresses. Frances Miles shouldered her way through the crowd. From the looks of it, she still baked herself in tanning beds, and blonde extensions did their best to snuff out whatever dark roots the bleach failed to touch.
"I can't believe it! Both of you together!"
She beamed.
"Merry Christmas Eve!"
I didn't recall her twang being so sharp.
"Merry Christmas,"
Charlotte and I replied together. Frances Miles had been a childhood friend to both of us. I didn't like her now, and I wasn't even sure I liked her back then, but friendships in small towns were like family. You often couldn't choose them.
"Charlotte, I'm so sorry about Will,"
she frowned.
"I saw your status change on Facebook. I thought about calling."
"Frances, you remember Paul?" I intervened on Charlotte's behalf. Paul extended his hand past me, shaking hers.
"Why, of course I remember Paul,"
she replied.
"Even if I didn't, I'd have television to remind me."
There was a note of envy in her voice that I doubted she meant anyone to hear.
"Y'all are coming to Ruby's tonight, aren't you?"
she asked, fingering a glittering tennis bracelet around her wrist. Ruby's sat on a corner a few blocks west of downtown. The pub was half bar, half dance club, and 100% high school reunion, especially on the nights before Thanksgiving and Christmas.
"We've had a long day of traveling,"
Paul answered for me.
Y'all have to come, Frances pressed. Everyone's going to be there. All the out-of-towners.
She looked past me and Paul.
What do you say, Charlotte? You deserve a drink after Will's mess.
Charlotte shifted her weight from one heel to the other. That was twice in a minute's time she'd heard her ex-husband's name. I felt for her, but I felt for myself more. A few drinks would ease my headache, and Mama had no doubt locked the wine cabinet before I'd even taken off from Reagan National.
Maybe we should go, Charlotte, I said. Blow off some steam and see everyone.
Frances's blood-red lips split into a smile from one ear to the other. Paul's face remained flat as a sidewalk. Between his constant watching and the liquor store closing for Christmas, there'd be no way to snag a stowaway bottle anytime soon. I'd suffer one evening at Ruby's for a stiff drink or two. Funny how I'd spent so many underage years trying to get inside Ruby's, and now it was nothing but a means to an end. A bitter pill.
Are you sure that's such a great idea? Paul asked.
The correct answer was obviously no. I swallowed hard and summoned a younger Gray to plead my case. The Gray who was the life of the party back when drinking was something I did for fun. With other people. I nudged Paul.
Nonsense. I haven't seen my friends in so long. Let's go. We'll stay for an hour. That's all.
He remained silent. I locked eyes with Charlotte, straining to keep desperation from trickling into my voice.
It'll be fun. Frances is right. You deserve some fun.
Her eyes cut to Paul's for a moment. They didn't think I noticed, but I did. She seemed as concerned as him. Seemed she'd spoken to Mama about me after all. Paul wasn't happy, but the hopeful politician inside him knew better than to show it. Manipulation was never a one-way street.
1 hour, he said, relenting. And I'm coming with you.
Of course you are, love, I replied.
Frances gave Charlotte and I both unwelcome hugs and darted back to her pew, victorious. The piano cut off as Pastor Calcutt stood, and we rejoined Mama and the twins. As the good pastor went on about Bethlehem and its bright star, the dull pain tugging at my temples loosened a bit. I'd have a drink soon, and knowing so stilled my roiling head. As soon as our rental car door slammed shut, Paul didn't mince words.
One drink, Gray.
His tone cut like a knife.
You've been drinking all day.
I ignored him. Instead, I began to think through all the ways my one drink might turn into four. Four was my goal for the evening. Four would unwind the knot in my chest and get me to sleep after. I'd make my first drink, the one Paul would see, into a double. That'd get me halfway there. He'd believe one trip to the restroom. There'd be time for a shot of something on the way. Ruby's would be crowded enough for him not to see.
Should I get a bourbon?
No, vodka. Better stick with clear liquor. Gin would be more festive. Gin tasted like Christmas. If Paul went to the restroom, which he rarely did, that'd be winning the lottery. I could replace my drink with a second double and sip it down to the level he last saw. If he didn't, I'd have to figure out something else. His sandpaper comment from earlier, the latest in an endless parade of digs, replayed in my head. I'd get drunk tonight. I'd get drunk, and that would be my revenge for his biting words. The thought was warped, skewed like my priorities, but I no longer lent a voice to the part of me that said so. Mama's face had burned, too, when we'd announced our plans. As she'd tucked her crocodile clutch under her arm to hold on to the twins, she'd turned to me and spoke low.
You watch yourself tonight, Gray. You hear?
People packed the parking lot of Ruby's, everyone sipping from glass bottles and solo cups under neon lights. Cigarette smoke and lime wedges, shouting and laughing and backslapping. Covered awnings kept most of the rain off, but the slick asphalt shined in all the wet. Charlotte's SUV pulled up next to our rental. Everyone in Elizabeth, aged 18 to 50, seemed to be there. Pockets of older folks, too. a radical departure from the Georgetown pub scene Paul and I knew. The look on Charlotte's face as we made our way to the front door told me it was different than the places she frequented in Raleigh. We'd both spent years away from Elizabeth, but Ruby's was like riding a bicycle. Step inside, and it all comes rushing back. And that's exactly what happened. Frances found us as soon as we stepped into the crowded bar.
Girls!
She spilled her drink as she hugged me, cranberry and vodka. I could smell it.
What are y'all drinking?
She asked. Water, Paul said. How about you, Gray? Water?
I'll have a gin and tonic,
I shouted. In bars, I deliberately raised the volume of my voice. It would give Paul doubt I'd heard anything he said, were it convenient not to. Ruby's, or the Ritz-Carlton, the rules of the game never changed. I turned to Charlotte.
How about you, sister? What'll it be?
The same.
You got it, guys,
Frances replied, looking at her own drink.
I'm due for a refill, too.
As she started off, I pushed past Paul and whispered in her ear, make mine a double, before adding, for the holidays. She winked and made for the bar. Despite the heels, I couldn't see the counter past the crowd. On the one hand, that'd make things easier when it came to my own refills. On the other, I couldn't tell how long the line was, how long until Francis's return. I clutched the strap of my handbag. The dance floor the next room over pulsed with bass from bad speakers. Even if I could hear over the music, it certainly didn't help my pounding head.
Gray King,
a man called from behind. I recognized the husky drawl almost at once.
Jacob Wilcox,
I answered, turning.
And it's Godfrey.
Gray Godfrey. Jacob looked the same, curled brown locks always a week late for a cut, his square jaw a week late for a shave. He hugged me. Tight. My thoughts went to Paul's eyes, undoubtedly fixated on this interaction. The fluttering in my chest dissolved into something else.
Hey, Charlotte.
Jacob smiled. She nodded.
I'm Paul.
My husband thrust his hand between Jacob and myself. Paul Godfrey.
Nice to meet you, Paul.
Jacob shook his hand. The discomfort of my situation sank in, and a lump built in the back of my throat. My husband and Jacob Wilcox stood nearly shoulder to shoulder. I wanted to vanish into thin air. Where the hell was Francis with my drink?
And you two went to school together?
A simple question, but it flew from Paul's mouth like an accusation. In this case, his suspicion was on point. I'd never told Paul about Jacob because Jacob was no ex-boyfriend. What I also didn't tell him was that Jacob and I were friends with benefits before either of us knew there was a name for what we did together. Jacob flashed a toothy white smile.
Yeah, we went to school together.
Jacob Wilcox!
Frances cried, like she didn't see him all the time. She returned with our drinks not a moment too soon. She hadn't the slightest sense of balance, so I grabbed mine fast. Should she spill any of it, there'd be no easy replacement. The liquor sloshing in my cup smelled like pungent pine. Frances winked again. Either she'd done well, or the bartender had an extremely loose pour.
Merry Christmas,
I told myself as I took a gulp. My earlier buzz crawled out from under my headache. I warmed up again as my cheeks flushed. I'd get what I needed from tonight and make it through to the other side.
have to be honest, Paul.
Jacob chuckled between swigs of Corona Light.
I know exactly who you are. Is that so?
Paul didn't appear amused. His patience with Ruby's had disappeared somewhere between stepping out of the car and Francis greeting us.
I see you on Fox News every so often. Saw you on Sean Hannity a couple weeks back, talking about solar-powered skyscrapers or something.
Paul nodded.
I'm a lobbyist for a clean energy think tank, Cooper and Waters. Maybe you've heard of us? Can't tell you I have. But I will say you put up a good fight for a liberal,
Jacob replied, speaking out of the side of his turned-up beer. He wiped his mouth and added,
Still think Hannity shut you down. I'll take that as a compliment.
Paul retrieved his phone from his pocket, shutting down the conversation. That damned phone again! I took in a mouthful of gin, already feeling more talkative. You know, Paul's running for Congress next year. Like Daddy. Men in my life followed the same ambitious pattern. The differences from one to the next, Daddy to Paul, were almost entirely superficial. Another swallow.
Paul!
Charlotte's mouth hung open.
You didn't tell me. That's wonderful news. We need more environmental lawmakers, no matter what Mama says.
Paul slipped his phone back into his slacks.
We're trying to keep it mostly under wraps until the party's finished vetting other potential candidates. But Gray's right.
Congratulations,
Francis added, no doubt hoping to punctuate the topic and move on. As I tipped my cup, Charlotte mentioned something about leaving early.
Gotta kiss the kiddos before Santa comes,
is all I caught before ice hit my upper lip. I'd finished my drink. I glanced around the circle. Paul's demeanor lifted as he went on about his work. Everyone else's eyes were on him as he practiced a stump speech. Between that and Charlotte's goodbyes, no one noticed I'd finished. Folding my hands behind my back, I concealed the empty cup.
I'm going to use the ladies' room,
I said aloud. Only Frances heard, probably anxious to leave a conversation she found dull.
You want me to come with?
No, no, I'll just be a minute.
I caught myself speaking loudly, not meaning to this time. My buzz returned strong, right off the bat. I might not even need four, but I'd try my best.
I'll catch you 2 in the morning, Charlotte said, interrupting Paul and slinging her purse over her shoulder. Lovely seeing you again, Francis. Jacob?
A rushed hug goodbye from Charlotte. After she vanished, I began shouldering my way past an assortment of people. Some I vaguely recognized, others I didn't. I spoke with no one. My small frame fit perfectly between 2 men standing at the counter.
Can I get you something?
The bartender asked, pouring a line of shots. Tanqueray and tonic, I answered. A double.
I like the sound of that,
one of the men said. A balding guy, built like a truck. He could have been overweight or all muscle, depending on how you squinted at him. He nodded to the bartender.
Add her in, too. I like a woman who can put down.
You have no idea.
You got it.
The bartender placed an empty shot glass behind the others.
I'm Jonas, he said, pointing to the shot line. And that's tequila.
Jackpot. A moment later, my double gin and tonic sat before me. A shot of swirling gold followed. I salted the back of my hand.
Merry Christmas,
I cheered with Jonas. I licked the salt and downed the shot. It took 2 swallows. Sour acid climbed up my throat between gulps. Still, I managed to keep it all down, and Jonas laughed as I sucked a lime wedge clean.
You want another one?
His lips split into a hearty smile. I nodded, and we repeated the ritual. This time, the shot slid down like fiery butter. My head swirled. I'd sleep tonight. I thanked Jonas, politely declined to follow him to a second bar, and made for Paul. As I walked, my shoulder jerked backwards. My purse strap had lassoed a stool back. I tugged, but it wouldn't give. I pulled harder. The older woman sitting on it turned to me, scowling as I rocked her seat. Before she could say a word, a hand steadied me.
Let me get that for you,
Jacob said, pulling the strap off the woman's chair. Thanks. I smiled and began walking back to the others.
Hold on, Gray,
Jacob said, stopping me with a firm hand on my elbow.
You've hardly spoken one word to me tonight.
Paul's here,
I said, slurring. Mama's words replayed in my mind.
You watch yourself tonight, Gray. You hear?
He doesn't know about us,
I added. Jacob smiled sideways, and his green eyes glistened from drinking.
Us?
Our history.
I closed my eyes, reopened them.
Or whatever it is.
He talked past me.
You want to go to the other side? Let's dance. You look like you haven't danced in a while. They even have dancing up there in D.C. with all those stiff suits and cocktail parties.
He joked, infusing faux skepticism into his words.
What part of Paul's here aren't you understanding?
More slurring. The shots had compounded with the gin, which had already met my bathroom wine from earlier. Jacob didn't stop.
Paul's talking to your sister and Francis. He's having his own good time. Let's skip over to the dance floor.
How many beers had he turned up?
I eyed him head to toe. His white t-shirt looked painted onto the contours of his hard chest, tiny features visible through a sweaty sheen. I remembered what his chest looked like, the warmth against my cheek as I laid my head on it.
Paul never allowed me to lie on his chest. Even if he did, there'd be nothing but his new beer gut to look at.
Okay, I said, taking another swallow. One dance, and then it's straight back to Paul. You hear?
My own drawl returned the more I drank. My husband detested it. Jacob took my hand and led me through the crowd onto the darkened dance floor, the next room over. A techno remix of Greensleeves blasted from the DJ's table. Creepy, but appropriate for Christmas.